Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business. When your business needs simplicity and efficiency, Nifty Business is the right fit for your fleet.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, is the world turning against Shein? We hear about its IPO woes. You've heard of the streaming wars, but what about the bundle wars, where your favourite TV provider forces you to watch everything with them? Plus,
I drew a map of Canada. Oh, Canada.
As Canada goes head-to-head once again with its nearest neighbour over tariffs, and Alberta possibly seeks independence, we hear about a country in transition. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, it's Jackson Hole Week, and that is the meeting of central bankers from all around the world in Wyoming. It's also on my bucket list. The world was watching to see what the tight-lipped Kevin Warsh would say, but the theme was all about financial innovation, implications for payments and policy. But what was underlying all of that was the enabler called the Genius Act. And that's what I wanted to focus on this week in my explainer. Now, the Genius Act became law last year and it has empowered the official start of the stablecoin era. And it promises a financial revolution that speeds up payments, settlements and clearing and could have long-ranging consequences for the Fed if it was to disrupt the traditional bank deposit model. So, in summary, the Genius Act leads to stablecoins, which had a particular influence on this week's Jackson Hole theme, which could change the way the world banks. Watch this space. Now, Shein was once valued at as much as $100 billion, fueled by its extraordinary growth in ultra-fast fashion and its popularity with younger consumers. But 4 years, two failed attempts later, at a public listing and billions of dollars in lost value. The company is now heading towards an IPO in Hong Kong on the 1st of September at a valuation potentially below $30 billion. So what happened to one of the world's most closely watched IPO candidates? And what does Shein's experience tell us about the changing relationship between Chinese companies, Western markets and global investors? Joining me now to discuss this is Arjun Neil Aleem, Asia financial correspondent with the Financial Times. First off, Arjun, will you just bring us through the business model of Shein in the first place?
Hi, thanks for having me. So Shein is most famous for selling extremely cheap clothing, and they design their business model around being quite asset light. So they don't own their production in China, but they use contracts with a load of factories, mostly across southern China. And they respond very quickly to consumer trends. And you may have seen either you or your kids order a lot of Shein clothing that comes very cheaply. It takes a while to arrive often, but they respond extremely quickly and you're able to basically get a whole wardrobe for pretty cheap on Shein. They've also expanded beyond clothes to other types of items, dolls, toys, furnishings. So essentially, it's a company that's able to make stuff very cheaply, sell it to you. It's kind of up to date, it's fashionable. And especially during COVID, this company really went quite viral on social media, TikTok, etc., for influencers showing off their Shein hauls.
I have to say, I'm not a fan of that style of business model myself. When you say you assume that I, not assume that I would, but the reason I'm not so much a fan is that the whole idea of fast fashion to me, obviously there's a sustainability side, but it also means that if something is being produced really quickly and really cheaply, that you are going to have problems in your supply chain and some form of labour practices that are going to be questionable. And that is without ever knowing anything about Shein, the company itself. Ultimately, isn't that the problem, though, with the overall topic of what we're talking about here today, which is the world is looking at that and saying, OK, now that not alone is that facing a commercial problem, it's facing a geopolitical supply chain and every other problem along the way.
Absolutely. But, you know, a whole load of consumers across the US, in Europe, even in the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and places, they absolutely love Shein clothing. And it is, you know, there are a huge amount of consumers that love to have the optionality. They love to buy a ton of clothing from there. Now, we're getting to the heart of the problem with Shein over the last 4 years, which is, you know, the way I put it when I speak about Shein is that they were too Chinese for some investors, for some consumers, and they weren't Chinese enough for regulators and for others. And this has been a problem. They've kind of bounced between being a company that does make a great deal of its items in China, but they're also a company that's headquartered in Singapore that tried to IPO in New York and London. And so they've really, this identity crisis is at the heart of why Shein is now limping to the finish line of an IPO in Hong Kong at a fraction, you know, a quarter of its peak valuation in 2022. So yes, that's a very good point, Susan.
But I don't want to let the point pass there when you say about being too Chinese and not being Chinese enough. I'm guessing that what you mean by that has not just to do with where they're based or headquartered or IPOing. There's something deeper in what you've said, is there?
Absolutely. I mean, when they were looking to IPO in both New York and London, there were huge questions about the origins, especially of the cotton that they use in some of their clothing, whether it comes from Xinjiang, which is a region of China in which there's been a lot of scrutiny over human rights abuses. You know, and then also generally across China and elsewhere, you know, the labor conditions that you do have in some of these factories, you know, especially for mostly women working there. So yes, there are a lot of questions about, you know, how and why the clothes are so cheap.
Okay, Arjun, let me put this another way, though, is that it's not just about a story of how the business is run or indeed the practices that they are happy to oversee in order to make this happen. From an investor's point of view, the story here has been super quickly produced clothes at a very low cost, keeping up with major trends and particularly targeting younger people and tying into the trend of e-commerce as well during the pandemic. Is all of that up for discussion now based on what's happened around the prices that people have to pay when ultra-low packages come into their houses due to the compliance costs, due to the fines that they're facing in Europe? So is the investment story changed?
The investment story absolutely has changed, Susan. So firstly, Shein was a big beneficiary of these de minimis regulations that essentially made lower value packages exempt from tariffs in Europe and the US. That's now being reconsidered. And so Shein clothing is about to get more expensive for a lot of consumers in the West who previously found them cheap. The other thing is, obviously, there has been this big backlash against mass consumerism and the kind of, you know, the kind of consumerism that's encouraged by Shein. And regulators are looking at that. Consumers are responding to this backlash. And the other thing is that Shein is not the only kid on the block now. And you have competitors both from ultra low cost options locally. And also there are things like Temu, which is another Chinese company that produces extremely cheap clothing. So Shein is kind of coming under fire from both competition from Chinese and local companies and also a stricter regulatory environment in the West.
In terms of the excitement in anticipation of next Monday and Tuesday, when we're going to see what price the shares are going to be made available at finally, and also then obviously the actual IPO, the initial public offering itself. What's the feeling on the ground in Hong Kong? Is there one of excitement or is it one of, as we've said, limping towards a finish line and hopefully this time it'll work?
Look, I feel pretty confident saying that Shein is limping towards the finishing line. You know, there was an internal aim to have a valuation of about $30 billion for the company. Don't forget they have $15 billion in cash on hand, according to the filings with the Hong Kong Exchange. But actually, the valuation that we're looking at is probably between $25 and $27 billion US dollars. So that's kind of lower already than what they were aiming for. And imagine if you were an investor like General Atlantic in the US, who might have invested in at a valuation of $100 billion, you'd be quite unhappy with what's happened over the last few years. You know, Hong Kong retail investors love a brand name, so I wouldn't rule out a IPO pop on the first day. Although, you know, it's hard to know what's going to happen in this market, so I wouldn't necessarily write off Shein. But it's fair to say that the valuation, the moving target, keeps getting lower and lower.
But if you work out simple maths there, if the company is worth $30 billion and it is $15 billion in cash, that means that investors are paying a very low price then for the rest of the business. But then, of course, that would assume that investors would want the business because they feel it could either turn around and or grow. So that valuation is... whatever about being much lower than the $100 billion, what is it saying even at the 30-odd?
Well, look, so the peak of net profit was over $3 billion in 2024. It's already come down in 2025. And they actually made a loss in the first quarter, an accounting loss in the first quarter of 2026. And they don't expect huge revenue growth, at least in the short term. So, there is a feeling that the kind of explosive moment they had during COVID, when everyone was bored at home ordering stuff on their phones, is kind of over. But they still have some technology. They still have their contracts and links with a lot of factories in China. They have a pretty devoted consumer base still. So, investors are buying a company that has proven able to respond to consumer trends quickly, that has produced a lot of goods that people want in the West and elsewhere. Whether they're able to cope with the new competition, whether they're able to adjust to the new regulatory environment is another question.
I'm interested that you pointed out their loss was an accounting loss. Is there something underneath that? Is that where you think, well, it is one-off occasions, or due to particularly the changes that happened in Europe around the de minimis? Or do you think something could lead for that accounting loss, as you mentioned, into it being turned around into an accounting profit in the future?
Yeah, the accounting loss was really a paper loss for them in the first quarter. It's a bit technical, but it's to do with the value of preferred shares. What that basically means is that they are still making money, even if they're making less money than in the best days of the business.
And this comes down to the crux of the matter, I think, is that when they were potentially going to list in New York and list in London, at that point, they were growing really quickly. They were right at the heart of trends where they had got such a significant advantage. Whereas now, I'm just wondering what it is that they're bringing to the market.
There's still a kind of, there's still a name in China consumer. They are a company that is very well known in the market. They're a brand name. They kind of pioneered the ultra fast fashion e-commerce model. And I guess an investor buying it is buying a, low margin, high volume consumer company. They're buying, Gen Z consumer trends. They're buying a company that has responded in the past to how consumers do change their tastes. And they are facing more competition, as I said before, but, you're making a bet that Shein can come back.
So what do you think there is to learn about this story, Arjun, when it comes to either retail or Asian businesses who are seeking to go global, or even those who have aspirations to go for an IPO and the challenges that come with it? What does the world have to learn from the Shein story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so Shein, as a company with Chinese roots, demonstrates that it is getting harder for these kinds of companies to find Western investors, to get into Western capital markets, to raise funding, to expand. I think that Shein is a parable of how that is getting harder. They could an IPO in New York or London. They're now coming to Hong Kong. There will be some Western investors that get in, but it is more difficult now. The other thing I think is that, I think Shein is kind of a warning to the West, because, it was shocking in 2022 when this company that came out of nowhere was worth $100 billion, was flooding our markets with this clothing, and local champions couldn't really handle the competition. But in some ways, Shein is yesterday's story, and now we're seeing this low cost story from China being repeated across higher value industries than garments. You're seeing it now in cars. You're seeing it now in batteries, in technology, and so Shein was kind of a warning that China is now able to harness its network, to harness the huge amount of businesses and companies across the country to produce things cheaper and better than in other places. And so now maybe Shein is yesterday's story, but today's story is BYD, today's story is Cattle. And even if Shein is not a success, we're going to see a lot more Chinese companies come into our markets.
Oh, I think you're spot on there, Arjun, for sure. And that's why this particular brand and the fact that it is now doing something that it tried to do twice before has really caught our attention. But for sure, we're keeping a very close eye on businesses that are on the rise in China. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Arjun Neil Alim, Asia Financial Correspondent with the Financial Times.
Thanks for having me.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we get ready for the bundle wars. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now for this week's trivia. I was in a place last week when on holidays with my mum, and I'm going to give you three clues to see if you can guess where. It was the birthplace of Impressionism, the home of Calvados, which is an apple brandy, and is the site of the largest amphibious military assault in history. Where was I? Have a think and I'll tell you at the end of the show. Now, for years, the streaming business was built around one simple goal: get as many people as possible to subscribe to your service. Netflix, Amazon, Disney, and a host of newer platforms spent billions creating exclusive content and fighting for subscribers. But the streaming market is changing. And increasingly, the battle isn't over who has the most subscribers, but who controls the app you open when you sit down in front of the television. So, are the streaming wars becoming the bundling wars? And could we eventually end up managing all our streaming through just one or two platforms? Joining me now to discuss this is Press Play's Olivia Fahey. First off, Olivia, is the age of easy subscriber meteoric growth over?
I think so, because at the end of the day, there's only so many people in the world, so there was always going to be some sort of top line. And even we've seen streaming services kind of trying to combat that by cracking down on the whole password sharing thing as well, so that they can try and increase their subscriber rates that way. But again, there's only so much of that you can do. So now they're trying to come up with ways to kind of keep people watching. And as much as they're creating their own content, that's also not enough to keep people watching, because we've seen it over the years with, say, for Netflix, for example, they had a show called Chaos, which I absolutely loved, and it only lasted one season. And that was so disappointing because I was hoping for season two and it had ended on a cliffhanger as well. So when you have things like that, it does kind of make people a bit wary to sign up to a service or to keep a service, because they're like, if I start watching this now, there's no guarantee there's going to be another season. So there's a lot of this kind of mentality going on when people are considering these things, because at the end of the day, we only have so much money. And if all of these bundles start happening, then that's going to be more appealing to people, because then they can save a bit of cash.
And I get that from the point of view of the subscriber, but I have been watching the Netflix earnings call every quarter for the past couple of years as my indicator of what's going on economically in that particular sector. And then there was going to be this great white hope of advertising, where there was going to be the different choice of paid tiers, whereby then they could be collecting money from those who sought to get in front of those who were paying to watch it. How was that unfolded, I should ask?
So there has been a lot of people who have opted for the ad subscription because it is just that little bit cheaper. And having watched Netflix when a friend of mine has had that option, you know, there's not that many ads. They're not actually as long. So I think in a certain way, people are finding that from a consumer point of view to be more cost effective, because it is just like watching the telly, except the ad breaks don't go on for as long, for example. But in other ways, especially with platforms now having live programming as well, it also gives them an opportunity to feed out ads to their viewers during these live programs as well. So there's been a lot of change with it, and the desire to kind of have almost different channels on your streaming platform is really coming in. So it's almost like we've kind of gone from having cable television to satellite television to streaming. And now we're nearly kind of going back to like the channel flicking, but you're doing it within your streaming service. So it's quite interesting, I have to say.
And I'm wondering why we're making that move, though. Is that because you can take away from the sense of something being live? Is it because we go back to wanting to knowing what's on and we don't want to have to face the paradox of choice? What do you think is driving that full cycle return to watching the telly on a different device?
I think there's a lot of factors to consider here, because when you're watching something, say, that drops all at once, you could be watching that over the course of a weekend, and then you may not switch on that streaming service again until the following Friday when the next thing all drops together. We're now seeing a lot of streaming platforms that are doing weekly drops, or they're doing two episodes a week or something like that. And that is a way of trying to keep people watching and keeping their subscription for longer. But on the other hand, you have people then who are, they won't watch something if they know it's a weekly drop until it's all arrived so that they can binge it, because we've gotten into this viewing habit so much that we just want to watch it all in the one go. So there's a different way of trying to keep the people there. But then you also have, like, a lot of the channels are now bringing in sports. So we've got, like, Prime Video has tennis. You have WWE, which I know is sport entertainment, but still, WWE, you've got UFC, and boxing is kind of on Netflix, and you've got La Liga on Disney Plus. So there's a lot of these different things that they're trying to bring in to hold people's attention. And I think it's that kind of the way that people are viewing. They know that if they have these live things, that people are going to want to watch them straight away. And then that way they're going to be engaged and they're going to be keeping their subscriptions for longer, if that makes sense.
Okay. But when we talk about what people can watch, I mean, Netflix hasn't got the exclusive rights, let's say, to every single sporting event that they might be streaming. So how is it that a company like Netflix can partner with, for example, the broadcaster in France most recently, in order to say, we are now bringing you exclusive content and content from another party that isn't Netflix, in essence?
So that is actually kind of what Netflix started doing, because when they first started, they were a DVD rental company and they were posting out, or they had like these machines in the US where it was basically like a vending machine for DVDs, which was gas. And so nothing that they were actually showcasing was their own stuff. Then they realized, okay, if we actually want to have more control over what it is that we're selling our subscribers, we're going to need to have to start making our own things. So I think one of the first ones that they did was like House of Cards back in the day. So like that was one of their first big series and it was a massive hit. And that's kind of what started the whole ball rolling. Now they're at a point where there's only so much stuff that they can make themselves. But also because all of the other studios, shall we say, have now started up their own streaming platforms, they're now also losing content that they had made the deals with to try and get more content into their own way. So as for example, like they were watching Schitt's Creek on Netflix. Schitt's Creek has now moved over to Disney Plus. So there's a bit of a vacant void. So they're now trying to come up with other ways of making these deals to either get the Netflix content onto other platforms themselves, but also get other content onto their own platform. So it's this weird kind of limbo area that they're in right now, I think. And a lot of streaming services are in that place at the moment where they're trying to balance between their own content, but then also keeping their subscribers by having other exclusive things that nowhere else has.
And I'm wondering, is it just about having the exclusivity, or is it about the habit that when somebody picks up the remote control, when they sit down to their TV, that whichever one it is, whether it's Netflix, whether it's Disney, or whether it's Amazon Prime, they are the go-to. Is that fundamentally what this comes down to now, is the native reaction of that person when they pick up the TV remote now?
I think because there is so much choice out there and there's a lot of, so for example, Google Chrome, when with their new device, when you turn it on, if you, depending on what streaming service you're logged in on, they will actually show you absolutely everything that you could watch next. So it's kind of showing you the full array of your television programming, a little bit like the kind of featured viewing option on Virgin Media and on Sky. So you're trying to make sure that you have these things that are going to draw eyes in. And it's the same with cinema. Like you want to see what's going to be the big draw to get the bums on seats in cinema. It's the same with television, whether it's satellite TV or streaming. It's all about what's going to be the most eye-catching, what's going to be the most talked about. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of people, especially in Ireland, I have always said that we suffer from FOMO so much that you'll nearly watch something just so you can join in on the conversation and see what everybody is actually talking about. You may not have any interest in, say, the likes of Love Island, but you might check it out just so you know what everyone's talking about in the office the next day kind of thing. So having these types of like viewing options that just draws people in, then that's going to be the main thing. And let's face it, like we've seen now with social media being so big as well, they're actually clipping things and people are watching shows nearly just through all of these clips that are just going viral on social media. And that's another way that's drawing the eyes in. So it's a very interesting time to be a television viewer, no matter what kind of platform you're watching it on.
I kind of get what you mean. There are certain things that I wouldn't sit down and watch an episode of, or certainly not commit to the series of, but I might have seen a few reels of it on Instagram or things like that. And I kind of get the essence of it. And so in terms of participating in those conversations, I have an idea of who's who and what they're doing without anything else, which, as you say, is a form of viewership in itself. Can I ask, though, about the non-traditional players here? Because we've talked about when or you might think of a streamer, you know, we might think again of those that I mentioned. But now we have YouTube and Peacock. So are we now seeing a new entrant come into the building?
Yeah, so I was actually looking up to see where Peacock lands on the sort of subscriber numbers list, because let's face it, Netflix is always going to be top dog. Amazon Prime Video, even HBO Max and Disney, they're probably like the four big ones. Apple TV is climbing up there as well now, especially with some of the absolutely stellar series that they've been producing. But Peacock is one that I think a lot of people over here have probably never even heard of. But similarly to what Sky did with HBO, they have a similar deal with Peacock in that a lot of the shows that we would have seen, like the Ted series, and there was a Natasha Lyonne series that I absolutely loved and cannot think of the name of it right now, but that was also a Peacock series. So we've already been exposed to some of their shows, but not through a streaming service. So now what YouTube has done is they've decided that, you know, YouTube has always been known as kind of like a more longer form video platform, maybe not to the point that you're watching full movies or series on it, but certainly you're spending more time watching YouTube than you are for the likes of like Instagram and TikTok. I've always kind of seen it more social media based, but they're clearly moving into this arena of actual like streaming services in terms of TV series and movies. And that's what this deal with Peacock is. So those who have their premium subscription will also have access to the Peacock platform as well, which, again, it's a risk in my opinion, especially because YouTube is so known for slightly shorter form, maybe not, again, not the TikTok or Instagram level, but certainly shorter than full like 30 minute length movies. But it's a risk, but I think one that it's going to draw more younger people's eyes to what Peacock has, as opposed to, you know, people who have like Netflix and or even like a Sky account. Like how many people in their 20s have a Sky account these days to be watching more television series? Well, this way they'll be able to catch these shows that are on Peacock through their YouTube account. So
when you say
good work,
when you say it's a risk for who? Is it? Do you mean it's a risk for YouTube trying to be too many things to too many people?
Yeah, I think it's a risk for YouTube because it is so synonymous with being more of a social media platform rather than a streaming service, if that makes sense. So in my head, it's categorized slightly differently to the likes of Netflix. I wouldn't have put it into the same bracket as them, but now it looks like they're trying to move into that arena. Like over the years, yes, we've seen like web series, like The Guild was a massive one for a while there, that they were the ones that were kind of doing all of this short form or longer form episodic kind of series. But that kind of died off in recent years. And now it's more like clip videos, and you know, they've also launched like YouTube Shorts to try and compete with Instagram and TikTok. So for me, I'm surprised that they're going back to this long form video content with this partnership, because they looked like they were moving more into the shorter form, if that makes sense.
So in a word then, are we looking at consolidation of the streamers where we'll basically pay for fewer of them, but we will get access to more of an aggregated sort of a content as a result?
I think so, because we're already seeing it in terms of the like the film and television studios as a whole. There's a lot of cannibalizing of each other going on. We already had it with Disney and Fox. We're now looking at it with Paramount and Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had already done something similar with Discovery. So they're all kind of nearly all going to be owned by one or two companies. And I think that's something similar that's happening with the streaming services, especially with there's always been like a lot of deals, like Hulu now is part of the Disney Plus brand and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see something similar happening with the streamers that we've had with the film studios. But also like for those who have Sky, they launched earlier this year, like the entertainment bundle. So now you can get Netflix, Disney, HBO Max all under the one package. But then also if you have Sky Cinema, you can get Paramount Plus as well. So whether or not that's going to then affect the Paramount and Warner Brothers deal down the line, because that'll also bring in HBO Max into play. So is HBO Max then going to end up on Paramount Plus or vice versa? There's a lot of question marks there, but we are sort of seeing this media conglomerate happening, and who are going to be the top dogs by the end of it remains to be seen. But and there's a lot of mixing and changing.
And I do wonder, all right, Olivia, whether we are at a pivot point now from where we went to, as you say, linear television into streaming, and now we're moving back to a digitised version of that. Thank you very much indeed for joining me to look at the combination of how all of this is working out. Press Play is Olivia Fahey. This is Susan A. Scullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, why Alberta, and not Quebec, is leading the charge for independence in Canada. Now, I want to turn westwards to two countries we have close ties with, namely the US and Canada. And last weekend, trade talks between both countries collapsed. And also, while Alberta's referendum on Sunday, the October the 19th, is not a straight vote in independence, it is a serious moment in Canadian and international politics. I'm joined now by Maria Cheng from Reuters to discuss this. First off, Maria, can you tell us what the basis of the demand for the referendum is in Alberta, first and foremost?
So there is a contingency among the Alberta population which has been very unsatisfied with how the province has been treated by Ottawa, the capital. Alberta is the oil-rich province in the West, and they do make a lot of money from energy sales. And they've been very frustrated with how Ottawa has been handling this under the previous prime minister, which was much more environmentally focused. There wasn't a lot of talk of pipelines. And so Alberta, there is a contingent there that feels like they would be better off as a separate country. And so they have petitioned to have a referendum. And in fact, the premier there, Daniel Smith, last year made it easier for this question to be on the ballot. And the question that Albertans will be voting on in October is not a straightforward, should we separate or not? It's basically, should we move on to a more serious negotiation with the government about separation? So it's kind of a question about a question.
I wanted to go back to the point you made about the geography, because Alberta is landlocked. So the only way that it physically could get that energy to another country, whereas if it was to separate, of course, that would be Canada. But further afield, of course, the US or Europe or wherever else it would go, would depend on the geopolitical relationship that it would have from that very entity that it seeks to separate from.
Yes, that is a very good point. And the province right next to Alberta, to its west, British Columbia, has made it very clear that it's not very interested in new pipelines, although the premier did acknowledge that he doesn't have the authority to veto a pipeline. And so that is up to the federal government. But it's true. Alberta is a landlocked province. And one of the other issues that's become quite contentious is that the province of Alberta sits on treaty land, meaning that it belongs to Indigenous First Nations Canadians. And so to separate kind of violates the treaties that these First Nations people have signed with the government of Canada. And those treaties were signed before Alberta even became a province.
So where do you think Danielle Smith actually stands? Because she said she doesn't want for the separation to happen, yet, as you said, she has made it more feasible. I mean, you're speaking to an Irish audience here. We've seen this before where Cameron pretty much said the same, and we all know what happened then in 2016.
Right. Yes. I actually was in the UK when that happened. I lived in London for nearly 20 years, so I remember Brexit very well. I think there is a similar dynamic happening in Alberta to some extent. You know, there is a portion of the population in Alberta that feels very aggrieved by what's happening, and that they think that they would have better opportunities to sign business agreements and oil deals if they weren't restricted by Ottawa. Whether or not the premier believes that Alberta should be separate, I'm not going to speculate on that. But she has said publicly she believes in a strong Alberta within Canada. But it is true that she has changed the laws to make it easier for this referendum to happen.
And as you say, the referendum is on the conversation about a conversation, as distinct to exactly what Brexit was. If we just zoom out a little bit and we look at what happened last weekend, the trade talks fell apart. Then we've seen the tit-for-tat tariffs. It has been the big story of the week. Can I first of all ask you about the position in Canada and where that stands now? And then I want to come back to how that is affecting the conversation then in Alberta.
Sure. I mean, Prime Minister Mark Carney on Saturday announced that the trade talks had broken down and that he instructed his negotiators to return to Ottawa, saying that basically Canada's sovereignty was not being respected by the U.S., that the U.S. was demanding too much and he was not prepared to make these sacrifices for a deal. So just earlier this week, Canada initiated announced a series of tariffs that match the U.S. tariffs dollar for dollar. So it's $20 billion worth of tariffs on imports coming into Canada from the U.S. And these are set to take effect in about a week. And the U.S. in return announced that it would levy more tariffs beginning January on a number of very important items for Canada, steel, autos, things like that. So at the moment, it appears that the two countries are at an impasse. The U.S. Trade Representative said earlier this week that there is no open channel of communication between the U.S. and Canada. So both governments are kind of standing firm. And certainly in Canada, there's tremendous support for the Prime Minister's effort to retaliate against the U.S. You know, polls have shown that 75% of Canadians support the hard line he's taking against the U.S., which, as I'm sure you know, has made numerous threats to annex Canada and has talked about it becoming the 51st state. And Donald Trump suggested changing the name of Lake Ontario in the most populous province in Canada to Lake America. So that has not gone down well with Canadians.
And I get that. And I get the support for the hard line, but when that translates to higher cost in people's pockets, do you think there could be a different reality then?
Yes, I think that's the most salient point here. I mean, it feels good, I think, emotionally for a lot of Canadians to support a government that's taking a harder line against President Trump. But the truth is, Canada is 13 times smaller than the U.S. and the entire population of this country would fit into California. So there are only so many levers that Canada can pull, and cost of living, housing affordability, these are all issues that are top of mind for Canadian voters. And it could come to a point that Canadians essentially say, you know, we would love to take this hard line against the U.S., but it's not sustainable. But how long that takes, that's the open question right now.
And therefore, does the conversation in Alberta and the timing of this, how does that change Mark Carney's hand, do you think?
I think it's never helpful for a province to be discussing separation at a time when unity across the country is so important. You know, in the reporting that we've done previously has shown that, you know, a certain segment of the separatists have been fueled by Donald Trump's brand of republicanism. And it's kind of the opposite effect that we've seen in Quebec, the French-speaking province, which has a much more longstanding sovereignty movement. And there the separatists have said, we are just going to take this off the table as long as Donald Trump is in office. And we've seen no such recognition of the obstacles that could pose to a separatist referendum in Alberta. So as far as we know, they are going ahead, even though there have been calls to postpone it.
Well, if we look then further afield again, whether it's Alberta or whether it's Canada or whether it's Canada minus Alberta, I want to ask you about the very clear message that Mark Carney was sending out about having a much deeper relationship with the EU. And we also saw the conversations that have been happening in recent times with Abu Dhabi and other regions across the Middle East. I won't go so far as to say, could Canada join the EU? Not because it's not geographically impossible, but because it's the substance of the conversation here is what matters more. How does he diversify away from the fact that 75% of exports go from Canada to the US?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think in the last year, the Prime Minister and his team have certainly been working to diversify Canada's economy as much as they can. And to that end, he's signed more than 20 trade and security deals with countries all over the world, as you mentioned, including, you know, China, India, Middle East, EU, across South America as well. But Canada is bound by its geography. the country cannot just pick up and move. And unfortunately, Canada's tied very much to the U.S. And in the previous decades, the free trade agreement across this entire continent between Canada, U.S. and Mexico created supply chains and production lines for automobiles and other goods that cross the border 7 or 8 times before there's a finished product. So this tariff war really is putting all of that in jeopardy. And Canadian politicians have made the point that these tariffs on Canada are essentially tariffs on the U.S. because of the frequency which with products move between the borders before they are sold.
You know, it strikes me the irony of so many things that Mark Carney is facing, whether it is the domestic question in comparison to the international question, whether it is the focus on energy, particularly gas, as well as oil and gas, but particularly gas, while trying to straddle that point on environmentalism. And then, of course, the results of the fact that the elephant in the room here is the interprovincial barriers within Canada present every bit as much of a tariff in inverted commas as what the US government is implementing on the country.
Yes, that's absolutely true. There are a lot of interprovincial barriers that still need to be addressed. And it's one point that the Prime Minister has made, that he is trying to eliminate barriers as much as he can. But at the end of the day, Canada is a confederation of provinces and territories, and it's up to these individual premiers to lower those barriers and to address how we might build the country within, given all the problems that we're facing from the south. So that's up to the premiers, but the prime minister has a limited amount of authority over what he can and can't do. I mean, one of the major sticking points for the U.S. has been the removal of U.S. alcohol from nearly every province except for Saskatchewan and Alberta. And when this was proposed to premiers, we know that you know, some of them have taken a very hard line. The premier of British Columbia said a few weeks ago that there was no chance in hell that this would happen. So that, unfortunately, is not something that's up to the prime minister.
If we can boil all this down, I want to ask you a potentially sensitive question here, and that is, if we look at the question around the referendum that could be, I think many would argue that Brexit was not an economic discussion, it was one of immigration. What do you think that the Alberta referendum could actually be down to? Is it simply down to oil, or is there something else?
It's a very good question. It's certainly not as straightforward as we've seen in Quebec, which does have a very distinct French language society that is different from the rest of Anglophone Canada. Alberta is slightly different. But there has been this faction in Alberta that has felt very aggrieved for a very long time. And we saw some of this during the pandemic. There was a previous blockade at the border at Coutts. And so I think there are probably a lot of issues tied up in that movement that align very much with Donald Trump's brand of republicanism. We've seen some Alberta separatists even float the idea of joining the U.S. So there's a diversity of opinion for sure. But also, I would just point out that polling has repeatedly showed that there's a very low appetite in Alberta to actually separate. I think it's around 30% that have said that they would support separation. And whether or not the trade war has an impact on that in the same way it has impacted Quebec is still unclear, since we're still, you know, a couple of months away from that referendum.
You know, there's a couple of things going on around the world around questions like these. Like, we've seen the Swiss referendum on the population cap. Iceland is also having a conversation around having a conversation about joining the EU. It seems to be just this kind of geopolitical tension. It boils over sometimes into ways in which people can express themselves. The last thing I'd just like to ask you is, looking forward now in the next days, weeks, months, given that stalemate between the US and Canada on trade and what has led to that stalemate, what's the feeling on the ground now about how this relationship is going to evolve?
I think there's no question that Canada and the U.S. need to have a relationship. As you pointed out, the geography just simply makes it impossible. And you know, more than 70% of Canada's exports still go to the U.S. I think the number of imports affected by these tariffs is still relatively small, about, 5 to 7% or something like that for both countries. In recent public interviews done by officials in both administrations, we've seen some effort to kind of lower the temperature. The U.S. Trade Representative said yesterday that he recognized that protection of French language was very important to Canada and this would never be a red line for the U.S., for example. And we saw the minister responsible for U.S. trade in Canada, Dominic LeBlanc, say that they appreciate that the Americans are recognizing that these are significant factors for Canada. So there seems to be a recognition that this cannot just end right now. This relationship needs to continue. But how that happens, we are still waiting to see how that plays out.
Maria Cheng, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and such an insight. Thank you very much for joining me from Reuters.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, for the answer to this week's trivia. Earlier on in the show, I told you I was in a place last week and I gave you three clues to see if you could guess where. I said it was the birthplace of Impressionism, the home of Calvados, which is an apple brandy, and is the site of the largest amphibious military assault in history. Where was I? The answer is Normandy. I brought my mam to Le Sieur first, and then out to the D-Day landings at Omaha Beach, had an apple crepe in Caen, before staying in Vernon, right beside Monet's home of Impressionism. So there you go. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan S. Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. You can listen back to today's show or any previous episode on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And already, I look forward to chatting to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business.
Sunday morning at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.